Just want to welcome back the audience. Obviously, it's the first time on video for Decoding Careers. It's like the second time. Ken Grief, big shout out to Ken Grief. He stitched me up on the first time. Director of Engineering at Domain came in with his full camera kit and said, today we're videoing.
Yeah, right.
I had the beard down here. I had the hair slipped back. I was like, man, I can't be jumping on the video. So it's the second time, but this is the first time back where we've actually done a full setup on the video. So myself and Dan here, we're going to get straight through this, but just bear in mind it is our first time. But welcome back to the audience. Obviously, last year we had some really good leaders on the show to talk about the transition from an engineer to a leader. I've got a slightly different type of guest on today's show, and I'm Daniel Palmer is sat opposite me, one of the founders of Relevance AI, and I'm sure the audience would have heard a bit about your business. You're making a lot of noise in the market for the right reasons at the moment. But yeah, welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
That's all good.
And I appreciate you finding the best medium for me. It's always good to cater to the guests.
100%. Maybe give us a bit of background in terms of Relevance AI as a business and the sort of the mission that you're on at the moment.
Yeah, so at Relevance, our goal is to delegate as much work as we can to AI. And we do that through a sort of technology called agents. So agents are reasoning bots, is one way to think of them, powered by foundation models. And so foundation models is a fancy word for something we've all heard a lot about lately. Large language models is a type of foundation model. Theoretically, we might have a large video model, and that's why we use that sort of blanket term. But these are bots that can be given dynamic work to do and instructed with workflows and sort of, yeah, like, diagrams and all the things that you would use to instruct like an intern or a new employee, and they can go out and do that work autonomously. The word we use is autopilot versus copilot. So rather than your ChatGPTs or your sort of built-in copilot solutions, like your LinkedIn just launched one, I think this week, we see a more autopilot solution where you can give your AI agents work, go away, come back, see what they've done, and they can report to you in a more traditional way.
Which is crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, even for us, it's crazy. Like, we've been around for 4 years now.
Yeah.
We've been playing in the AI space for that whole time. And this is not exactly where we thought we would be in 2024, but in a good way. Like,
okay.
I did not realize that AI technology in an accessible way was going to be able to solve this form of automation in 2024. Because it's a type of automation that I think has been dreamed about for a while.
Mm.
The thing I always talk about is like how, like even like the early pioneers of capitalism, and like I say this not to like be like a big neoliberal capitalist, but just like even from the theory of early capitalism, they always talked about how technology and the capitalist system would lead us to working less. And I think it was... I don't want to misquote. I think it was Friedman who said that we would have a five-hour work week.
Oh, wow.
Like, eventually it would converge to us just doing so little work because we could automate so much. And we've never seen that really play out. In fact, we've ended up working more rather than less. We create new technology and it tends to give us more work to do. And what I think is really exciting about this sort of automation is that I think it can finally help us reduce our need to work and take away a lot of work that we do because we have to, but we don't enjoy. And so, yeah, exciting, interesting world.
Yeah. And with that, though, if the AI, the automation piece is working and it's streamlined, wouldn't it create more work for yourself, but doing the work that you can have more impact and more of the work that you're going to enjoy?
100%. Like, that is definitely, especially the initial impact of this that we're seeing. So the companies that we work with, we've not found them wanting to like replace workers or like replace existing work and just delegate it away entirely to AI. Generally, what it allows them to do is either restructure the positions they have so that they can do different types of better work. So for example, our flagship agent right now is a sales agent. It particularly looks at the sort of roles that an early BDR would do. And so a lot of that is like cold prospecting, research, sending out emails, replying to emails, then booking calendar events for, you know, your real salespeople who take the meetings. We're working with companies who want to give their BDRs more responsibility. They want them to be able to take some of those meetings and actually make an impact at that sort of more fulfilling level, rather than doing all of that grunt work that really they just shouldn't have to do. So yeah, in many ways, it allows people to restructure what human work looks like rather than just take it away. And other things we've seen are like, there are all sorts of resources and types of work that companies have that they just don't take advantage of or even have time to think about because they just don't see an ROI on hiring a team to go take advantage of that resource or do that type of work. That if we can quickly allow them to delegate that to AI, there's all sorts of like new resources and potential for companies that previously just kind of sit in cold storage.
Nice. Yeah, it sounds interesting. It always sounds too good to be true though, doesn't it? But it's like, I've did a bit of reading on the business before, like 6,000 customers, users within like a space of 3 months. And this was an article back in December. So I can probably appreciate there's been a few more users that have jumped on recently. Recently had your round of funding as well. I think it's 15 mil Oz. So it shows that, and with some good investors behind you as well, it shows that you're onto something. And it's an exciting time. And it's you've only been running 4 years as well. So it's crazy how sort of fast you guys are growing.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely felt like in some ways we were too early for this. For a lot of our, like, we started in 2020 as a vector database. So maybe some of the engineers listening will understand that's like a niche form of data that you can use to do things like semantic search or clustering. And that was our world for 2 years, working with unstructured data and trying to figure out how to use vector embeddings to generate insights. We really felt at that time that we were too early on the vector idea. Like, we'd go to companies and be like, hey, we've got this concept. Do you guys see a need for it? And they're like, well, what is a vector? And then we have to explain that. And then maybe eventually we got better at just selling the benefits. But there was just this sense that this wasn't the best way to utilize vectors. And what's interesting now is that like a really core part of how people use LLMs in production for like interesting use cases, like what we're doing, is actually powered by vector databases as like a fundamental piece. There's a concept called RAG, which is just a fancy acronym for using vector databases to give your LLMs relevant context so that the LLM doesn't have to store everything. It can kind of pull from the database. And so that's a really fundamental technique at the moment in our space that it's funny for us to kind of look back on and be like, ah, yeah. So we did figure out one of the key pieces. We just got it too early. But finally now it feels like the world has kind of coalesced around what we were building. And yeah, so it's been an exciting year and a half since ChatGPT and stuff came out.
Yeah, because it's definitely a buzzword at the moment, the AI. Everyone's talking about AI. But yeah, no, that's interesting. Well, let's jump a bit more talking about your background. So notice that, and I'll let you sort of run me through it, but notice that you come from like a content sort of marketing background, which is really interesting in terms of having a different perspective on the show. Maybe if you want to we'll start with just talking through your journey and then what made you sort of transition into that sort of engineering route.
Yeah, it's a tragic tale, my journey. Nah. So from a young age, I was around code all the time. My dad was a software engineer. Me and my cousin, who we grew up together, we were obsessed with building things and we were always building websites. We ran one of the world's biggest RuneScape forums for a while, then one of the world's biggest Yu-Gi-Oh! Forums. We were all over that sort of thing. We were in Microsoft Publisher and really like enjoyed dabbling our hands in that sort of like really basic coding, HTML, CSS, the early no-code tools essentially. Always been obsessed with building things. I think something about my dad being an engineer almost turned me off like pursuing that as a career. I kind of wanted to like try to attack it from a different angle. And so I always thought that like, okay, business, that's how you build things when you're an adult, you know, like you don't make Yu-Gi-Oh! Forums, you make some sort of business, right? So out of school, I went into uni, studied commerce. I thought marketing would be the sort of branch of commerce where I'd be able to flex my need to be creative and build things, because, you know, building ads and marketing campaigns felt like that sort of work. Very quickly realized that, no, this is not like actually the hole I was trying to fill. I really craved the more technical layers. I wanted to get into the details a lot more than I was possibly able to do in marketing. And I wanted to actually get involved with the product. The good thing about studying marketing is that it led me into my first internships. And so I interned at a couple of startups where I just fell in love with the atmosphere at these startups. And most importantly, got to sit in with, you know, these are small teams, sitting right next to the engineers, with the product designers, and really just started to feel like, okay, now I'm starting to understand what the role like looks like, where I can make that contribution I was looking for. And so I worked a couple of jobs as a sort of, yeah, content creator at startups. And probably the last couple of people who hired me in that role would have seen that my eyes were not on the game of marketing. I was just soaking up what the engineering teams were talking about, and started learning the code on the side. I ended up actually dropping out of my degree before I'd finished it and going to do a like General Assembly, just part-time boot camp. So I'd be going to my marketing job, pretending to care a little bit, doing a bit of code while in my lunch break, and then going off and learning in the evening until I felt confident enough to just commit to that fully, started what became my first startup at the time, and really learned how to code proper through that process of running my first startup, Tribefire. So yeah, that's like a speed run of like how I got from commerce to engineering.
Yeah. And then, so your first, obviously you did a bit of internships at the startups and stuff, and you went into a few bigger environments as well. I remember we were speaking about previously, and did you quickly realize that the startup world is for me?
Yeah, I think what I've learned about myself is that it's not necessarily specific types of work that I'm good or bad at, but rather like frameworks of work. And so I'm really good in situations of MVP and iteration. Like I'm good in fast moving environments, and I treat not just my engineering from like an MVP iteration point of view, but even now my managing in that point of view. And I think that's where I perform the best. This is something I've learned. And as you mentioned, yeah, like after I went through those startups, ran my own startup, after coming out of that experience, I was like, okay, I need to see what life looks like on the bigger end of town. Mm. And so I went to work at this like massive conglomerate. They own a whole bunch of retailers in Australia, $1 billion company. And I went, sat in on their e-commerce team where they were building like the e-commerce platform, and they didn't use anything. They were using like legacy systems. And turns out I landed there, and all of the engineers there were almost exclusively engineers in their specific legacy system that had no applicable applications outside of that company. And things move very slowly. And if you have to make any change, you have to ring up like the company in India that initially built their platform and get like ask them exactly how to do it, because there was no documentation. It was a really crazy experience. And I'm sure it's like not fully indicative of what it looks like at these companies. But what I did realize is that I'm incapable of doing good work in those contexts. Other people are, and that is totally fair play to them. I was frozen, and I felt like I was there for a year, and I felt like I didn't learn anything. I didn't really come out of it with much more than like small pieces of process that I've maybe taken with me at best. But yeah, I've realized that like I've got to optimize for what sort of working environment I thrive in, and that's always been startups for me.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Do you feel that was a benefit for yourself that you went in and sort of your own eyes rather than hear about it though? Because you can sort of just get that, cancel that out of your life. Right, I've tried that, I didn't like the taste of it, so now I'm back here, and now I know this is where I want to be. Is that important, would you say, for engineers to try both, or would you just go with one and go straight at it?
Oh, 100%, like MVP and iteration. Like, yeah, that's the framework I apply to everything. I think try it, definitely try it. And I'm glad I did. If you go look at my LinkedIn, I've probably removed a lot of the jobs I did work. Like, I tried everything. I have to make sure that I've tried it, otherwise I don't know. And I think it's similar to like, yeah, building software out, especially at a startup, is a lot of time you ship the feature, you get the feedback, you iterate. You can't spend too much time trying to preempt what it will feel like to ship that feature. So I do think if there is a huge curiosity in you, you should try it out. And then you'll come out of it knowing about yourself and knowing about what you thrive in and what you like. And that information can't hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And let's talk a bit about the role at Relevance here. Obviously, one of the founders, part of the founding team in terms of engineering. Maybe take us back to the very start of that journey. Just try and paint the picture of what that looked like, sort of how you started and sort of where you are now.
Yeah, so it started with there's another Dan in the founding team sending me a message. We had met each other a couple of years prior when I was running my previous startup. He worked out of one of the co-working spaces that I worked in, and we started chatting and kind of bonded over random technical things that we both enjoyed talking about. He is like extremely good at shipping product. Him and Jackie, the other co-founder, have built apps that have millions of installations on the App Store. They built, like, when Pokemon Go was a massive thing, they built, I think it was called Pokemap, something like that, that had millions and millions of downloads. Everyone I knew had that app. They're really awesome at that, like, that same shipping iteration process. And so I bonded very quickly with them. And so Jackie worked at a big insurance company, head of engineering there. IAG, head of machine learning, not engineering. And kind of stumbled into the vector databases and realized, okay, there's something here. There's something here. We just need to create a team of these iterators and see what happens. Like, it really was like, that kind of sounds like a retro, like I'm retrofitting the mentality to what happened, but it really was like, we didn't know what was there initially. We just knew there was some interesting technology that something would come out of. And so that's all they messaged me with. I spent a lot of my first year at Relevance building plugins for Fortnite. One of our early customers was like a company, a pretty big company who build embeddings into like games that like help you out with like suggestions. And so we were using vectors to build like an AI recommendation engine. And so I just remember having to boot up Fortnite. I would walk my character out. I would like chop down something, and then I would like look at the logs in my code and then shut it down and go change something. A really interesting part of my life. We tried so much and iterated so much. And I don't think we could have landed in the position we are if we didn't. We were never going to predict this is where the world went, as I mentioned. So I think in general, we're just, our biggest competency is like iterating and trying to sniff out good opportunities and just throwing our energy at them until we figure something out.
Yeah. And then more from an engineering perspective then.
Yeah.
So obviously at the very start, you would have been hands-on on the tools, coding all day.
Yeah.
After speaking with you a few weeks ago, over the past year or so, maybe a bit longer, maybe a bit sooner, you've gone through that bit of that transition in terms of managing and leading people, more from the management point of view and sort of leading as well. What challenges have you faced in terms of that transition? Because as you're probably aware, it's a common problem in the market. It's a real problem that people go through when they're making that transition. Maybe talk to us a bit about what that was like for yourself.
Yeah, I think it was definitely very challenging because it's an entirely different role from being an engineer to managing engineers. I think one of the things that makes it challenging is, you know, there's a lot of information out there about how to be a good manager, and you know there are all sorts of techniques that people have developed that they might learn in business school or something, and like you're just so constantly aware that probably what you're doing as a manager isn't the best way you could be managing this person. And I think that was something that crippled me initially. Like, I was, like, looking back, I don't think I was like the most effective manager initially. And but again, to bring it back to my core thesis that I didn't walk into here expecting to keep repeating, what I've since realized is that, yeah, that is the reality. You probably could be doing a better job with that managing process than you are. That's the same with most of your work. And so it's just a matter of iterating on the process of how you manage the teams. And I'd say a lot of that iteration has to be kind of inspired by a need as well. I think if we had tried to read up all of the management techniques initially and apply them, or take even what we're doing currently at Relevance and apply it to our first two engineers, it would have just created a lot of wasted time. There's a lot of process that is effective at certain sizes that's not effective at smaller teams. And it's easy when you're in that small team to think, oh, that's what they do. They're successful. I should be doing that as well. But really, they're doing it because they're at that size and they've been forced to. These sort of managing processes are tools. And really, I think my biggest takeaway is that you should try things out in your management until you're forced to adopt one of these tools. Then you can go out, research it, learn about it. There's heaps of resources, and you'll bring in your own good instincts based on, you know, working with the people that you're managing, and apply those process tools when they're relevant. I think that's probably one of my big takeaways from that sort of experience of growth.
Yeah, okay, interesting. And there is a lot of information out there, there's too much, and then you end up doing a whole lot of nothing because you're getting that perspective, and all of a sudden you just become lost. Yeah. So it's quite easy to do, not just in management, across anything that you're trying to sort of learn more about. In terms of the transition that you've gone through now, like, because I know from speaking, you're still on the tool slightly because you need to get stuff done. That's just the reality. You've got to jump in to certain things. What advice would you give to engineers that want to have come into like a management role, but they're still finding themselves jumping in coding? Is there any sort of advice you can give in terms of like time management or how they can effectively manage that?
Yeah, you really have to communicate that balance. We've also in our team promoted engineers into slightly more management style roles now, and I've seen them go through the same challenge of, especially the things that you're asked to dive into when you're in that sort of more senior role, they can be complex things, like really technical or fundamental pieces of the code base. And so generally, you need to get your head into that deeply. Like, I'm not just going around updating buttons. Like, that's not a good use of my time. If I'm doing some work, it's usually like, we need someone who has like a lot of more experience or a lot more understanding of the code base to do that sort of work. And so it's so important that you communicate to your team and to the other people who are surrounding you who might be able to help you with the managerial workload, that is your focus for whatever the time period is, because you can't do both. You just really can't do both. And if you try to do both, you damage your ability to work, but also you hurt your team who, if they think they can rely on you and they end up waiting, you know, they ask a question and they're waiting twice as long to get an answer because you're off coding for a while, that slows them down. It just has this huge compounding effect. And I've just seen it so many times that it has to be clearly communicated. And if you do clearly communicate it, you can get away with it because other people in your team will help you pick up the slack, or you create processes with your team for, okay, you're not going to get as quick a reply out of me or whatever the consequence is, but here's how we'll deal with it, so that they at least know how it's going to work and they can work within that framework. But yeah, I guess that's my advice. Just like, don't expect to be able to do it both. You just really can't.
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of engineers need to be cautious in terms of taking on roles that you are expected to do both. I think, would it be fair to say that it's probably really beneficial to have that conversation early doors before you accept the role and go, well, look, you mentioned that we need to get through this. The reality is there's only so many hours in the day. How are we going to split my time and sort of managing expectations from the get-go? Would you sort of recommend, like you mentioned, it falls into communication. Is that sort of how you would sort of run with it?
Yeah, it's funny. We had a new engineer start today and I was talking to him about like the number one pitfall I see with engineers is not lack of ability. It's lack of communication, 100%. They talk about managing up, and it's so fundamental because really, as a manager of people, your best interest is that they communicate everything that they're thinking to you. Otherwise, you're just kind of making some blind guesses, or you're setting estimations that are just entirely unreasonable. And that's not fun to do. As a manager, I don't want to have the wrong expectations of what person X can do. It's not fun for me to just create some unrealistic one and then judge them if they don't hit it. That's like, no one wins there. Maybe there's some sadistic people that enjoy that, but I doubt it. So as speaking from the manager perspective, if you're sort of asked by someone who's managing you to do something like that that's unreasonable, or like they might not know it's unreasonable, communicate it. That helps them. They'll be delighted to hear that. And yeah, I definitely recommend that.
Yeah. No, interesting. And what about, there's been quite a lot of conversations that I've had recently with engineering leaders in terms of the two different routes you can go down. Obviously, you've got the individual contributor route, or you've got the sort of lead people team lead route. How, like, there's a lot of engineers that are asking me, I don't know which route to go down. What sort of advice would you give to engineers that aren't sure of which route to go down?
Yeah, I guess two pieces of advice. The first being that they're very different roles. And so it's not like a natural progression where you go from senior engineer to some sort of management role, and it's just like your previous job but upper level. It's a new job. You've moved almost horizontally there rather than vertically. And so have that expectation. Assess it like you would a new job. If I came and you're an engineer and I'm like, hey, do you want to go work as a firefighter? Yeah, like you've got to think, like, is that a sort of work I want to do? I think you should almost have that perspective. Like, really treat it like a new job, and don't expect to be doing the same things or even flexing the same muscles. And it can be really rewarding. And I'm personally very much enjoying it. But I would set that expectation. And then the second piece of advice I had is that I think like there's many doors that you can go back through. And given that my perspective on life is to iterate, I think it'd be intellectually honest for me to say that you can try it. You can try going to if you're a good engineer and they try to promote you into a manager role and you know, you don't like it or you're not good at it or whatever, they're likely to be happy to take you back to what you were doing before and doing presumably quite well. So feel free to try it would be my advice, because it's, as I said earlier, it's best to know, and don't feel like you're walking through a one-way door.
Yeah, and I think that's bang on. And there's also the conversation I had with the same leader was, even if you go to tech lead, it's easy to transition across to team lead. It's quite easy, but the further you go up, the harder it is to transition. So I think trying to get it right at the start will make your life a lot easier. Now, lastly, we always talk about what we've done well, especially when you read a lot of books. It's always about what's gone well, what people have done well. What are the two biggest areas, like the mistakes that you've made in terms of transitioning that you can maybe talk about to help other engineers not maybe fall in the same trap?
Yeah, great question. I'd say one thing that I'm really bad at and didn't have to deal with as an engineer, but constantly have to deal with as a manager, is having tough conversations, like tough people conversations. And I would say I avoided that initially because it just wasn't the sort of thing I ever had to do. It's uncomfortable. And so I'd say for the first year of managing people, I would avoid the tough conversations, and inevitably that would hurt everyone involved. And so I guess advice number one is definitely, like, as much as you can, try and get over that barrier. It feels painful, but it will help everyone if you're honest upfront and have those regular tough conversations. And that's something we're still getting better at because it is tough. And personally, what I do is I like to lean on maybe some, like, other Dan, he's great at those conversations. And so part of it, I guess, is maybe if you know you're not good at that, figure out who you can lean on and play almost like a good cop, bad cop role. We've found that quite effective. And actually, it's been useful for me to be very often the good cop, because I'm day to day managing these people. And so we have a good friendly relationship, and poor Dan every now and again has to go sit him down and have like a tough conversation. That's one way we've tried to manage it. But I think in general, that is a skill that I've been poor at and I'm constantly trying to get better and better at. And I guess like an analogy is, like, you don't feel afraid to have those conversations in code. Like, if there's like a piece of your code base that you think should be refactored, like, it's not a weird, awkward conversation. I think we can maybe think about work in the same way, like in a similar way. Whereas these tough conversations are very rarely personal. They're very rarely like, oh, you are a bad person or you're incompetent. They're usually, you're doing this thing in a way that we could probably do a lot better. And so I like to think of it a bit like refactoring code. That's always a really positive conversation. That, like, yeah, that's a little technique I've used. What other advice would I have? I think don't be afraid to hire and manage people who are better than you at code is probably the biggest one. I think it's easy to feel like you will lose control of the code base when you do that, or like you will become invalid because it's like, well, this person's better than me. Why am I telling them what to do? So much of that management job is not about telling them how to implement code. It's not necessarily about, micromanaging what they write. And so their great ideas, their great techniques that they bring to their engineering, they can flourish. Your job is to help them flourish. Your job is to help them flourish in the right direction. These are very often things that really good engineers don't want to think about. They don't want to think about, oh, is the feature I'm building, like, has it been validated with user testing or anything? They just want to build it as best as they can. And so they're happy for you to go take off that workload. And so I think that's my biggest advice, is because once you start bringing in people that are more talented than you, it actually becomes a lot easier to manage. Of course, they do work better, but also, like, I think you start to understand, like, okay, this person is really good at this problem that I might not know the answer to. So I don't have to feel like we can't do that sort of work because I can't manage this person to help them do it. I just need to understand the problem really well, be able to communicate that and have faith that they can go figure it out. So I think there's a lot of unlocks when you have really talented people in your team. That sounds really obvious now I say it, but I think it's actually quite a mental hurdle to get over when you move. It's like almost like an imposter syndrome that you're trying to defend against by that's probably a big piece of advice.
Brilliant. No, I think there were two real killer pieces of advice. And I think the good cop and the bad cop, the reality is you've got to stick to your strengths and your weaknesses as well. You can't sort of do it all, and you're going to be stronger at certain points. So I think that's definitely relevant. And I think that can be a problem in terms of hiring people that are better coders than yourself. But I think ego there as well, you've got to be able to sort of just let that happen, and you can then focus more on high level activities as well whilst they sort of crack on with the day. So I think they're probably the second one. I think there's a big challenge in the market where people are happy to step back and let go. Especially when you're a founding engineer of that team, you're like, this is my baby. How am I gonna let this go?
100%.
So I think that's interesting. Well, Dan, I think that brings a close to the end of the show. What's next for Daniel Palmer, and what's next for Relevance AI?
So as you mentioned, we raised in December 15 million Series A, growing our team, where we need more engineers. If you're listening to this and you want to work on probably a multi-generational defining company, if we pull it off, and surrounded by some of the most talented people I've ever met, I'm constantly blown away by the talent we've been able to collect in our little team. Please let me know. We're even trialing, and this is actually kind of interesting, we're trialing a program called Work Trials, where people are able to come work for us for a week, get paid at like a good rate. We'll bring them in on a real project, embed them in our linear, in our Slack. They get to see what we're working on and what we're like to work with, and we can see the other way around. Feel free to message me if you think you're a good candidate for that, and that's a great way for us to both evaluate each other. But yeah, hiring engineers. So yeah,
sounds like a few engineers are going to take annual leave then.
Look, no comment on how our most recent start did his work trial.
No, brilliant. Well, look, really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I've learned a lot myself, and it's exciting times for Relevance. But yeah, appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, it's been fun.
Cheers.